Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
In a few days' time, Australians and New Zealanders will pause to mark Anzac Day and pay their tribute to those who made the ultimate sacrifice for their nation in war and to all those who followed in their service in our armed forces. It's interesting, over the last decade or two, as those diggers from World War I have faded away, their memory has been kept powerfully alive as Anzac Day, and especially Gallipoli, has been seared into our national psyche. It's been quite a phenomenon as thousands of Aussies and Kiwis are drawn to those rocky shores in Turkey to commemorate this day each year. I'll share with you one very special moment in my life, a very privileged experience that I had there, in just a moment. I'd love also for you to share any of your own experiences, if you've been one of those many, many Aussies or Kiwis who flocked to Gallipoli to see it firsthand, drink in the history, reach back to a defining moment in Australia's national story. Have you been able to make that pilgrimage? I'd love you to share with us your reflections, what you saw, what you felt. Join us on 1300 40 2020 as we look forward to Anzac Day on Open House. The other really interesting story that's been played out in recent years is the way Australia and Turkey, the enemy in the Gallipoli campaign, have formed a very special bond to grasp the relevance of a campaign that was significant for both nations' identities and ideals. At the moment, a really important five-year research project is underway to, in a way, complete the story of the Gallipoli campaign. For there's still much that we don't know about what happened there nearly a century ago, especially from the Turkish side of the campaign. The director of this Gallipoli research project is Harvey Broadbent from Macquarie University, who joins us now on Open House. Harvey, welcome.
Thank you very much, Lee.
It's great to have you with us. Harvey, the Gallipoli story is a very large part of your own career long before this project. What so strongly drew you to it?
My first job was actually in Turkey, teaching English. And one summer, in fact, it was 1968, so long ago now, my wife and myself were camping on a beach in Turkey, and it turned out to be on the Gallipoli Peninsula, not far from Anzac Cove.
Wow.
And we knew nothing. We were 21-year-old English people, you know, just straight out from university in Britain. We knew nothing of the Gallipoli campaign or the details. We just knew the name, and that was it. And then suddenly we were there on this beach, not far from Anzac Cove, and our Turkish host told us the story of the Gallipoli saga from their side. And from that point, I was learning Turkish. When I came to live in Australia in 1975 with my wife and family, and we emigrated, £10 poms, we, in fact, realized that my background in Turkey and my Turkish language expertise could add a lot to the Gallipoli story for Australians, because
yeah,
we realized how important it was for Australia and the national identity of the country, the formative historical event in the new nation, as it were, back in 1915. That was how I came to contribute to it.
Harvey, how do you account for what the experts like you describe as a real phenomenon, the way Aussies and Kiwis have embraced this almost pilgrimage to Gallipoli, where previous generations haven't?
At the time, after the Gallipoli campaign, of course, back in the First World War, it became very important for Australians. Gallipoli became the big name for after 1915, and commemorations continued through the 1920s. Anzac Day was gazetted throughout Australia in the early 20s as a national holiday. But then it kind of faded after the Second World War, and through the 50s and the 60s, when the anti-war sentiments grew in this country, and the Vietnam War with its divisions within the sort of collective consciousness of Australians began to question things about surrounding war. But then it kind of came back in the 70s and the 80s. Interest grew. Because interest in Australian history started to grow in the 70s and the 80s, a lot of films were made about Australian historical events. Books, more and more books were being written. And then suddenly, in 1990, the 75th anniversary of Gallipoli, the government decided to take back 50-odd diggers, original Anzacs, who were still alive, and they were in the late 80s and early 90s. And the government took them back in 1990 to the Dawn Service and the Lone Pine Service there. And there was a great national outpouring. I was working at the ABC at the time and did all the broadcasting. I produced the live TV coverage on that day from Gallipoli, 5 hours of live television. It was quite groundbreaking at the time, too, all satellite connections and that sort of thing. Yes. And we had a massive audience. And I can trace it from that time, from 1990 onwards, the attendances at Gallipoli started to rise year by year. So since 1990, there have been around about 7,000 or 8,000 a year attending the Dawn Service in Lone Pine, sometimes more on like the 85th or the 80th, the 85th and 90th anniversaries. They top 10,000 or more. Mm. So, and also Gallipoli has entered the school curriculum these days. It's taught in schools far more deep than it used to be. And consequently, young people, when they do their gap years or they go over, do the grand tour of Europe, you know, they go to Britain and travel around Europe, they go to Gallipoli and they know the story a lot better than they used to, and yes, they relate to it.
What do you believe Gallipoli means for that average Aussie or Kiwi?
Oh, I think it's definitely a question of recognising one's national identity. I'm an Australian citizen now. I was naturalised in 1985. I took dual nationality out, and I feel it as strongly as most Australians do that was a seminal event in the establishment of the country, because it was the first time Australians and New Zealanders have fought together as Australians and New Zealanders, as not as colonies of Great Britain. As a nation, remember 1914, the outbreak of the First World War, was only 13 years after Federation. So there was a strong feeling of we are a new nation. And this gives us this identity. And because it was the first war in which many Australians lost their lives as Australians, and not just as New South Welshmen or South Australians or West Australians, but as Australians per se, and I think this resonates strongly through those people travelling, particularly the young people who go over there, and they feel they are Australians in the old world, and they feel they've got a lot to offer, but they see a little piece of Australia when they go to Gallipoli.
Yes,
and that's what Bob Hawke said in 1990. Here we are, he said on the TV broadcast, we're standing on this little piece of Australia. It might not be, technically, of course, but it feels like it. And even the landscape, which is so stark and barren and reminds one of lots of parts of Australia. You know, it's that climatic similarity as well.
Yes. So tell us about this project you're heading up. It's got a special interest in following up all the archives from the Turkish side.
Mm. A few years ago, I was researching for the book, the last book I wrote in 2005, Gallipoli, The Fatal Shore. During the research, I came across this huge archive of Turkish documents about the Gallipoli campaign in the capital city of Ankara. And I thought, my goodness, no one's ever looked at these things before. And of course, they're in Turkish. They're in Old Turkish, which is written in the Arabic script. So this explains why they really haven't been looked at before in great detail. And I thought, what a wonderful idea it would be to actually get a research project which we could look at these documents and make a much more comprehensive and detailed history of the Gallipoli campaign, particularly from the other side, because once you look at what the other side were doing, the enemy, the Turks, then it explains how things actually happened.
Yes. What new insights have you gained
It's more the sort of filling in of all the details, like, you know, at the landing, for example. You know, we hear the Australians landed at Anzac Cove and this happened and that happened, but we don't know why. Now, what the documents are telling us is that there were 120 troops around the perimeter of Anzac Cove only, that there were another group over there and another group over there, and it was very dark, and the orders were sent out, and the Turks were trying to get their reserves forward, and the telephone broke down, the telephone communication, so they lost their communications to their headquarters 3 or 4 kilometers away. But they did dispatch. We knew how many troops they dispatched. We can now piece together their movements, which allows us to explain how the Anzacs were stopped on the 2nd and 3rd Ridge, how they weren't able to penetrate further. And we've got all those details from those documents.
Yes. It's also an event for Turkey that's been quite a defining one in that nation's national story as well. Why is that?
Well, it was the first... Well, I mean, Gallipoli for the Turks was a victory. After 9 months, 8 to 9 months, the Allies, in the Anzacs included, left, retreated, yes. Evacuated, whatever word you like to use, and left the Gallipoli Peninsula to the Turks. So they look on it as a great victory. And this was the first time they had actually defeated, in war, a European power. Now, there were two European powers, great powers, Britain, three powers, in fact, Britain, France, at Gallipoli, but they were also fighting Russia on the Eastern Front. So they had been defeated in battles, you know, for the previous 20-odd years when they were fighting the Greeks and the Bulgarians in the Balkan Wars and the Italians in Libya. And they'd received defeats. And this was their first big victory for many, many years. So that's how it becomes important. And, of course, also their most successful commander at Gallipoli was a man called Mustafa Kemal, Lieutenant Colonel Mustafa Kemal, who later becomes the first president of the new country, the Republic of Turkey, not the Ottoman Empire anymore. Kemal Atatürk, as he became known, becomes a huge figure, yes. Historical figure, in the world of the 1920s and 30s. He's the great hero at Gallipoli for the Turks, because he's the most successful commander there. Not the only commander, not the only successful one, but the most successful. And so Gallipoli is often tied to him as much as to anyone in Turkey.
Javi, if you fast forward to today, there's been quite a relationship, bond, established between these Anzac nations and Turkey. Mm. And you've been seeing that firsthand. What's that connection look like, feel like?
It's a very interesting one. I mean, at first, when I started going in the 80s, in the late 1980s, started visiting Gallipoli more frequently. You know, the only people you see there around Anzac Day or most of the other times of the year looking over the battlefield were visiting Australians and New Zealanders. And then with the 90s and this sort of upsurge in travel to Gallipoli from Australia and New Zealand, and what I call Gallipoli tourism, the Turks started to look at it a little bit more with more interest, because, of course, it was beneficial to them, their local economy for tourism, and they started to build infrastructure better and that sort of thing. But they were also inquisitive as to, you know, what is it which is bringing these people here? Yes. So they started to look at their own history a little bit more, and not just to look at Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, the man, but the things he'd done at Gallipoli itself. And that started an interest. It's now entered the Turkish school curriculum in more detail. It's now been decreed by the Turkish government several years ago that in the lifetime of a Turkish school child, they must pay at least one visit to the Gallipoli Peninsula. Wow. To see it. So it's become important to them. They use this newfound relationship with Australia diplomatically, of course,
yes.
Because they can say, you know, we are peacefully reconciling our differences. We're interested in peaceful reconciliation from former enemies. That makes them look good. It makes them feel good. Gives them a bit of credibility in the world. And so they're playing on this a lot. The most interesting thing, Lee, of recent years, the last 3 or 4 years, is the increase in the number of religiously minded Turks going to Gallipoli, carrying out religious services on the battlefield, praying to Allah, their God, for the salvation of their nation back in 1915. So there's kind of parallel situations going on between what's happened in Australia, say, 20 years ago, and what's happening now in Turkey.
Javi, is there any one particular story from Gallipoli that's particularly struck you or moved you, of all that you know?
There are so many which come through. I mean, the Australian War Memorial contains lots of diaries of soldiers, and when you read them, you know, you get a real feel I came across one, actually, in the State Library of New South Wales, in the Mitchell Library, when I was doing research. It was written by an Australian writer of semi-fame. He became reasonably well-known after the First World War. His name was Harley Matthews, and he was a poet and a writer. But he was a private soldier at Gallipoli. He'd enlisted in the 1st Brigade out of New South Wales, and in the 1st AIF. Every day he wrote in his diary on his notebook his feelings about being at Gallipoli. He produced this book, and he writes in very moving terms about being in the trenches and how on one particular day all his cobbers around him, as he used to call them, his mates, were convinced there was a sniper in the Turkish trench, and that was a woman. They were convinced it was a woman. It's a strange story, Lee. The Turks had this sharpshooter who was a woman, and they tried to knock this position out, and when they did, they actually succeeded. They brought up a sharpshooter and succeeded in knocking out this sniper, and they took the trench over, and when they got there, of course, they found it wasn't a woman after all. It was a man who was the sniper. But the story tells you about the kinds of almost superstitious elements which entered into the relationship and the soldier's experience at Gallipoli. Yes. That's one story. Actually, Harley Matthews becomes important after the war because he goes to Britain after being demobbed and survives the war, and he becomes the model for the unknown soldier statue in London.
Wow.
And he's an Australian, he's an Anzac, a poet, and he's the statue. There's no name on it, but he is the unknown soldier. And then later on in the Second World War, he becomes a conscientious objector and is interned.
Wow. What an amazing story.
Yes, amazing stories. The other one, of course, is an English soldier who I have his diary, and I interviewed him back in 1987. George Peake from the Lancashire Fusiliers. And he told us and wrote in his letters to us that when he arrived at Gallipoli just a couple of weeks after the landings in the first contingent of the Lancashire Fusiliers reserves, the reinforcements, he landed at Cape Helles, and as he landed, he said the place was just strewn with bodies everywhere. He couldn't believe it. He thought he'd come to hell, he said. Walking into the jaws of hell.
Poor soul. We're coming up to the centenary, of course, of Gallipoli. What's planned for that, Harvey? It'll be quite a year.
2015, the centenary of the Gallipoli campaign. The Australian government is already working on arrangements for the commemorations at Anzac Cove and Lone Pine on that day, 25th of April. My information, Lee, is that they expect thousands and thousands of people to make their way there, and they are having to think about the commemoration as an event. They're planning it as an event. They're going to construct special seating, special transport arrangements, and they're going to limit, as I understand, the number of people who will be able to actually get into the commemorative site to 25,000. They're putting a figure on it.
Which you'd understand, because it's not that big.
That's not that big at all, the area, no. And, of course, the logistics of moving all those thousands of people to this remote area. The idea, which is being discussed as we speak, is to make a ballot for tickets. So it'll be ticket only, it'll be balloted, and then if you're lucky enough to get a ticket, you can go. If you're not, then you have to find another means to commemorate the centenary in 2015.
It's such a significant event.
Wow. So it's going to be a huge event.
Yeah, it'll be quite an event. Harvey Broadbent, very much appreciate your time. Thanks very much for joining us on Open House.
You're very welcome, Lee, and I hope everyone has a fabulous Anzac Day this year.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. Thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology Solutions. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.